So I know some people are still getting seated, but welcome. As a Pitt grad, I know that Pittsburgh here today is a bit of a homecoming for me, and for our featured speaker, a bit of a homecoming as well, since he signed originally with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we're going to get to Dick Bosman in just a couple minutes here. Real quickly, I do want to cover some business of baseball items and make sure that proper call-outs are made for where they belong. It was a great year. We published the second volume of the History of the Winter Meetings book in December of 2017. So if you haven't obtained your copy, please make sure you do so. You're missing out if you have not done that. And 19th Century Committee is in the process of publishing a volume 3. So we're doing a little bit of a prequel there. I'm not heavily involved with it. They're doing some great work on a prequel with it, and I'm excited to see that book when it comes out in December of 2018 here. So a special call out to Bill Nowlin and Marshall Adamson and Len Levin for all their work on both volumes of the Winter Meetings book. Another larger scale project is also underway, and Andy McHugh leads up the team ownership history project. I know he's got a couple items he wants to bring up about that.
Thank you, Steve. As you know, we've been working on this project for 3 or 4 years now, and this past winter, thanks to the work of Jacob, we were able to get a site within the BioProject website and begin to post the first of the team ownership histories on the Sabre website. There are 9 of them up there now. There are 5 more in Len Levin's editing process, which we hope to get out in the next few months. And then there are a group of others who somebody has volunteered to do them, and so we're hoping to make progress on those. For you folks, I just wanted to read out the list of the franchises that are still available. We are looking for essays that trace the ownership of each of these major league franchises and the major duties of the owners, such as providing a place to play baseball. And as I said, it's been very rewarding for a lot of people that have done these essays, and you can read them on the website. But available, and I hope many of you will be walking up to me later and volunteering to do them, but let me read the list. The Milwaukee Braves, the Atlanta Braves, Milwaukee Brewers, Washington Nationals, San Diego Padres, Pittsburgh Pirates. Somebody here ought to be willing to do the Pittsburgh Pirates, huh? The Cincinnati Reds since 1968, the Rockies, all of the various A's teams, the Blue Jays, the Orioles, the Rays, and the Royals, and possibly the Cardinals and the Rangers. Somebody has volunteered to do those 2 teams, but I'm having a very difficult time getting a hold of them. So if any of you are interested in digging into the research for those essays, please grab me sometime during the rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy, and that's a really important project. I don't know if Andy realizes or not, this was something similar around ownership histories and then also a general manager's database that we discussed going back into probably 2005, so really important work for the committee. One last call out to my co-chair, Michael Hoppert, who isn't here today but continues to do an outstanding job on Outside the Lines, and always delighted to have Mike is a co-chair. Also delighted to have Dick Bosman here today, and it's a great opportunity to discuss some stories from the formative years of the Players Union. And as I kept researching more and more about Dick, I learned more and more about some of the things he did related to the business of baseball, so I'm pretty excited to hear what he has to say. Call out to Ted Levengood, who is up here at the end of the table, who really is the brains behind putting this session together. Ted and Dick put together a book. If you haven't seen this, this is still available in the vendor's room at 50% discount today, 30% with your, and I don't think I have the paper on me, but with the Sabre code for the discount following convention, Dick Bosman on Pitching, and I'm going to read from the back of this in a moment, but Ted had reached out to me as he and Dick were talking, and Ted was the one who realized just how many connections and as a player rep and as being involved in the strike both from a player's side and then also from the side of a pitching coach, just how unique and how full Dick's experience with that actually is. So to read from the back of the book real quick, Dick Bosman's career in Major League Baseball as a player and coach has spanned more than 50 years. Dick Bosman on Pitching, Lessons from the Life of a Major League Ballplayer and Pitching Coach, examines Bosman's life in baseball from his winning the ERA title in the American League in 1969 and his no-hitter in 1974 to his current coaching position with the Tampa Bay Rays. For those wanting an inside look at the essentials of pitching, this book also includes insights and tips from Bosman compiled from hours of personal interviews. Bosman has worked for and with some of the best pitchers and coaches in Major League Baseball, and he shares not only stories from their time together, but also the many things he learned from them about the game. So there is a quick intro on Dick Bosman, and then, you know, in 1974, when somebody like me stood up here stalling to, you know, where the main event was about to happen, after Dick pitched his no-hitter, they started chanting, "We want Bosman." I was actually going to ask the crowd to do that, but my wife said Sabre crowd probably isn't the right crowd for that. So without further ado, Dick Bosman.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Well, we've covered a lot of miles to get here today, and it's been an absolute pleasure to come back to Pittsburgh. Not that I was here very much, because I signed with Pittsburgh out of high school, so I never saw the city. I saw Kingsport, Tennessee, and I pitched 1 year down there, and Al Kubski, my manager, called me in after the season and said, "We're going to put you on the AAA roster," and I thought, wow, I'm moving up pretty quick. Well, what I didn't know is they were going to protect me from the Rule 5 draft, which I knew nothing about. The only draft I knew about was the military draft, which I ended up in later on. But that was the last year I was with them. I got a letter during the wintertime that said my contract had been traded to the National Exhibition Company. And I went, did I go to the circus or what? I didn't know. I mean, I was a kid out of Wisconsin, you know, and so I called Paul Tretiak, my scout, the guy that signed me. I said, "What's going on here, Paul?" He says, "Hey, congratulations." He says, "You're going to the San Francisco Giants." He says, "You're going to big league camp with Willie Mays and all them guys." I thought, wow, I'm already in the big leagues. So here I am on an airplane. Second time I flew on an airplane out to Arizona. In the middle of the night, we land in Phoenix, and a bus with Giants on the side picked me up. And it's the middle of the night, and here we are riding through the darkness, going out into the desert. We go to Casa Grande, and at that time, Casa Grande was in the middle of the desert. And we landed out there, and I got off that bus, and I went, where in the hell am I? I mean, I'd never been out of Wisconsin other than Kingsport. So anyway, that was my introduction to baseball. No, I didn't make the big leagues that year either, by the way. I ended up in Lexington, North Carolina with Max Lanier, D-ball. And that began my education on how to get to the big leagues. I was with Ray Miller there. Anyway, that's a story for another day. Red Barber, the noted American sportscaster, was quoted as saying, "The two men who changed baseball the most was Babe Ruth and Marvin Miller." I see a few nodding heads out there, so maybe we're on the right track here. I first heard Marvin Miller speak out in the outfield in Pompano Beach in spring training in 1966. I was a non-roster invitee to spring training that year, and Marvin was making his tour of the camps. And he had just been elected as our executive director of the Player Association. And I got to tell you, when Marvin spoke, it was E.F. Hutton for me. We listened. And at that time, I intuitively knew that if I could be around Marvin Miller, I was going to be a better and a wiser man. I would be a released man later on, too, by the way, but that's coming, okay? But, I mean, it was mesmerizing, his voice and what he had to say. Now, understand, we're just starting. I mean, there had been attempts to to start the Player Association for a number of years. But, of course, ownership had squashed most of that, you know, in its embryo stages. And Robin Robertson and a number of the guys had gotten together to find out if they could find somebody who was going to be better qualified to do that, and Marvin was recommended. So, of course, Marvin had to tour the camps and get elected and all the other things, and, of course, at the time, ownership was trying to make sure that the reps at the time didn't elect him either. Because I think intuitively they knew what was coming. So I decided I wanted to be a rep. Oh, by the way, the reps were driving Chryslers at the time. They were getting courtesy cars. Now, I was a Corvette driver at the time, so the Chrysler didn't excite me a whole lot. But it was a car. So, you know, it wasn't long in Washington, of course. There was quite a turnover. And as we'll talk here, the player reps were turned over quite often also. So it wasn't long before the alternate got traded or released, so I became the alternate. And for 11 years, I was that guy. And I wouldn't give it up for nothing. Honestly, I would not, even though there were some trials and tribulations along the way, because, you know, I got a chance to be around this man. I got a chance to sit in these smoke-filled rooms and watch him negotiate with the owners. And it was quite an experience. Going forward, you know, I scuffled a little bit, got sent to the minor leagues, got to pitch in Hawaii for a summer, which was quite an experience for a young 21-year-old kid. But I went there to pitch. I didn't go there to do much of anything but pitch and pitch 200 innings over there and learned how to pitch. We had a bunch of old guys on that club, Gene Freeze, Hector Lopez, Willie Kirkland, John Orsino, guys like that, they were kind of on the downside of their careers and probably figured that was a nice place to spend the summer on the way out, which it was, if you could handle the travel. Because the travel was, you know, we didn't have jets in those days. We were flying four-engine Constellations back and forth between the mainland and Hawaii. So fortunately I was young and could handle it. Some of those older guys, they didn't do it without a bottle of vodka, let me tell you. Now, we played when we got where we went. You did not want to be the pitcher that night because half the club was still in the bag. But anyway, it was quite an experience. To get back to the big leagues then the next year, and then, of course, Ted Williams came in as our manager. Bob Short, our new owner, brought in Ted. Ted didn't like pitchers very much. They were his adversary, of course, over all the years. And, you know, he didn't mince words when it came to antagonizing us, I guess you might say. In the presence of us and the writers, he would say, well, what's dumber than a pitcher? And they would all say, we don't know. And he'd say, well, two pitchers. Now, for some reason, he took a liking to me. And I'm forever grateful because from the neck up, the great man taught me how to pitch. And it made all the difference in my career. I won the ERA title that first year with Ted and ran off 608 in a row at the end of the year. Won 16 the next year with admittedly a bad club. But I learned how to do things, and a lot with what I teach those kids in Tampa Bay today has a lot to do with what Ted taught me. You know, you flash forward now to 1972, and we're in spring training, and negotiations are going on with the owners over, basically it was pension and health insurance, and as the negotiations went forward, the owners actually reduced their offer. Marvin didn't want to strike. He wanted to negotiate through the summer and felt like if he did, then we would be better informed and perhaps he would get to know us better and we'd get to know him better. Well, at the last meeting, I think it was probably the 30th of March, us 47 reps elected to strike right then. And Marvin's like, well, I hope you guys know what, you know, what's in front of you. No strike fund. Very little in the way of communication in those days. You know, we didn't have these cell phones and all that kind of stuff. But Marvin always was one who wanted to go with the will of the players. He counseled us and advised us on everything. So on the 31st of March, I walked into the clubhouse. Don Mincher was in New York. Davey Nelson was with Marvin. And I'm the guy there. And I said to Frank Howard, I said, Hondo, I said, we're walking out today. And I said, I need you to stand up there with me. So here we are in there. And I said, fellas, the executive board is elected to strike right now. I said, I'm heading for Texas. And I said, you guys that are going to Texas, here's my phone number. And we're going to get together when we get down there and see if we can keep working out. We didn't know how long it was going to last. And they've never done anything like this before, of course. Well, about that time, Bob Short walked in and he says, fellas, I need you guys to get on the bus out here and go down to Fort Lauderdale and play the Yankees. And Hondo, in that big booming voice, you know, 6'8", about 290 at the time, he said, Bob, the executive board is elected to strike, and until we have an agreement, we're not playing. Let's go, men. And out the door we went. And I told Hondo later, I said, champ, I said, I'm glad you're standing up there with me, pal. I said, my legs were shaking so bad, I'm not sure I could have walked out of there. So anyway, the strike lasted 15 days. We were in Texas. And, you know, we didn't have a strike fund. My wife was overdue with our first child. And I was looking in the paper for a construction job. If it lasted another week, you know, we're all probably going to work. So fortunately, the strike broke. And we went on with the season wherever it was going to be. We went to Anaheim, and Andy Messersmith beat me 1-0. We came back 5 days later, and I beat Messersmith at our place, and my daughter Michelle was born after. She was born after the game. My wife was in labor all day and never told me. I always said she had her priorities right. I was pitching that day. Now, that spring, 16 out of 24 player reps were either released or traded. That became a, I don't know what you want to call it, a byword, an epidemic, whatever it might be, but player reps were on thin ice. And yet every year I felt and believed that what we were doing was the right thing. Now understand, the reserve rules are still there. You know, we were getting concessions, we were getting better pension, we were getting better health benefits, but the reserve rules were still in there. And every time that it came up, you know, it was, you know, it wasn't even on the table. These guys, you know, the ownership didn't want anything like that. They didn't want, you know, they didn't want to have everything go away that they had all these years. So now I get through Cleveland. Dave Duncan was the rep over there. I was the alternate. Then I was the rep after Dunk left. And I no-hit Oakland. And then the next spring, I get traded to Oakland. The story went that Bando and Jackson went to the owner and said to Finley that, you know, if I was good enough to no-hit him, I was good enough to pitch for him. And Catfish Hunter, of course, had gone to New York because there was a loophole in his contract. He had an annuity, and Finley wouldn't pay the annuity. And they put a 10-day registered letter into Finley to conform to the contract, and he refused. So they went to the judge, and the judge ruled that Cat was a free agent because the contract was violated. And, of course, you know, everything after that was history with Cat. He went to New York and did a marvelous job. So now I get traded to Oakland. So I'm in Oakland, and, you know, everybody's there except Cat. The entire outfield, the entire infield, Phil Garner was my roomie. And we have a meeting about 2 months after I get in there, and Sal and Reggie are the rep and the alternate, and they're like, we don't want to do this anymore. We're trying to negotiate. Free agency's coming. We know free agency's coming. And they were trying to negotiate a deal with Finley. They all had beautiful homes in the mountains and so forth. It was a great place to play, even though it was really cold there. So they looked at me and they said, Bozzy, he said, you've been doing this, huh? I said, yeah, I've been doing it for 8 years. He said, well, why don't you do it? And I stood there and I looked around the room. And we got Billy Williams, we got Ron Fairley, we got Willie McCovey, and all the others, Reggie and Sal and Campy and Ray Fossey and all these guys. Now, you know, when you played for Charlie Finley, you were flying commercial, and sometimes you were flying day of the game, And, you know, whatever happened, they always went to the player rep and bitched like crazy to the player rep. We never got any satisfaction, of course, but that's what they did. And I said that. I said, guys, I said, most of you guys have more time in the big leagues than I do. And I said, when time comes, you're going to retire, you're going to want your pension. I mean, at that time, again, you know, the average salary in the big leagues was like 50, 60 grand. And I said, you know, now that you have an opportunity to serve your association, you guys are hiding in your lockers. And then I didn't say anything. And nobody spoke up. And I got to tell you, intuitively at that time, I knew that might be my demise later on. But I said, I'll do it. I believe in what we're doing. And I'll do it. So I did. So we won the division that year, easy. You know, we got beat in the playoffs by the Red Sox, just didn't do the things we should have done. And of course, 3 out of 5 in those days, and you either win it or go home. So I went home. I was pretty bitter. I only got to pitch a third of an inning. I was supposed to pitch a third game, and Finley wanted Holtzman to do it, so he did, and we got beat anyway. So the next year was chaos. The next year, Finley tried to sell guys. He knew Theo was coming. He sold Rudy, tried to sell Raleigh, Vida, and Bowie Kuhn, right, Bowie? Yeah, Bowie Kuhn, in the interests of baseball, negated the deals. Well, they're off with their teams already. In fact, I think there's a couple baseball cards around with Joe Rudy in a Red Sox uni. Probably a collector's item. Maybe some of you guys have it. I don't know. But we found ourselves playing with a 22-man roster one night because these guys hadn't come back yet. And I talked to Marvin. He said, you've got to tell Finley he's got to restore the roster or he ain't playing. So here we go again. So he's like, no, we ain't doing it right now. I said, well, if we don't have 3 more guys here by 6 o'clock tonight at game time, we're not playing. I'm pitching that night. So I told Sal, I said, I'm going to go out and get loose. I said, if you guys come out of the clubhouse at 6 o'clock, I'll know that he relented. And I'm loosening up, and I'm looking, in the clubhouse. They're still not coming out. Well, 6:59, here they come, whooping and hollering out of the clubhouse. He gave in. But you understand, you know, that this all this did was alienate him just a little bit more. And that's the way it was. So now, 76, we get beat out late. Kansas City beat us out. Probably, I think it was the last 10 days of the season. It was just, you know, we just weren't the same club. Even though the same guys were there, it wasn't the same club. Guys had their minds going wherever they were going already. So now the spring of 77 comes. And the only guys left off the playoff club in 1975 was me and Vida Blue. Everybody else was gone. A bunch of kids. So the spring went along all right, I thought. I didn't talk to Charlie a whole lot that spring. And then on the 31st of March, we were getting ready to go to Sun City. We had a player rep meeting over there. And Jack McKeon was our manager. And he stuck his head out of the manager's office. He says, Bozzy, Charlie's on the phone. I said, all right. So I went in there and picked up the phone. It was Charlie. He was in Chicago. And he says, I understand you got a player rep meeting today over there in Sun City. I said, yeah, we're going over there today. He says, well, he says, you probably have to elect a new player rep because I'm releasing you this morning. I said, you're doing what? He says, yeah, you're going to get your release this morning. I says, you know, you could have traded for me this winter. I was 16-4 here in 2 years. Well, I didn't have time. Good luck. Click. So that was it. McKeon looked at me and said, what's up? I said, yeah, what's up? You didn't know, did you? What? I said, I just got released. Oh, yeah, well, we talked about it. I said, yeah, you sure did. So long story short, I was done. I didn't want to go to the minor leagues. I didn't feel it was appropriate to go to the minor leagues. If my arm was bad or wasn't pitching good, I'd have gone. But I went home. I called Hondo, said, champ, I'm all done. He said, well, you know what's best for you and your family. So I went home. That was it. I knew that nobody was going to call. Later on, I heard from Phil Garner. He, of course, was in Pittsburgh. And he says, well, the rumor around here was that Finley spread a rumor that your arm was bad. I said, well, it's not, but it's a moot point now. So that was the end of my career as a player. And, you know, the other strikes along the way, you know, after free agency, we all know the bonanza that it was for the players. They finally had a chance to find out what they were worth. They finally had a chance to play where they wanted to play, for the manager that they wanted to play for. No, I'm not bitter. I'm not. I'm proud of the time I played. I'm not. In fact, my wife tells me all the time, I'm glad we're not playing today, honey. She says, what we'd have done with all that money? And I said, yeah, but a couple mil would have been all right. You know? But seriously, I think I played in a great era. I certainly played with a lot of great guys and a lot of great teammates. And I think it was a golden era of baseball. Not that it's not today, with a lot of wonderful players around. But you know, the strikes since then, the 81 strike was about free agency. 94 strike in Baltimore, I was the pitching coach there. And Mike Mussina and Jimmy Poole were the reps and the alternate. A couple of bright kids, both Stanford guys. I talked to them quite a bit about the issues. And all along, it was about trying to break the union because Marvin Miller was the guy. You know, if it would have been for Marvin, we'd have never gotten where we got, and they'd never be where they are now. You know, why he's not in the Hall of Fame is a damn shame. We know why he's not in the Hall of Fame, because there was ownership on the election committee. There's a couple other reasons, too, but I'm not privileged to go into that, and I really don't want to. But Marvin Miller, for me, you know, every time I went to New York as a pitching coach, and I had 11 years in the big leagues as a pitching coach, and every time I had a chance to go in New York, I would call Marvin, and I'd take him to lunch, because it was a privilege to take that man to lunch and sit and talk. And I cherish those days. I really, really do. You can talk to just about any of today's players. They probably don't even know who Marvin is, which is a shame. You know, when I first became a big league pitching coach, I remember opening day in whatever major league city I was in, there was a case of books in the locker room. Excuse me, and it was Marvin's book, A Whole Different Ballgame. And they gave them to the rookies so that those kids could read how they became and how they came where they are. And it's important, you know, that they understand and know why it is and how it came to be that they have what they have. You know, minimum salary in the big leagues is $550,000. The average salary in the big leagues is over $4 million. You know, our pension plan has no peer. You know, the benefits that these guys have today, the medical benefits. Now, my wife says that the pendulum has swung the other way. She says it's gone too far the other way. You know, the players have more sway, they have more influence on what happens now than they ever have. Well, some of it's pretty good, some of it maybe not so good. But the point is that they've got representation. You know, this contract they've got right now, which is probably another subject for another day too, is probably not as good as what they wanted to be. This salary cap, not salary cap, this luxury tax that's going on right now is a salary cap, if you want to look at it that way. $197 million, and you know, clubs don't want to go over that. So a lot of times if a player wants to go somewhere else and they're like, well, I don't want to go over the cap, well, what's that? Same deal, right? But everybody's got their opinions on that. I'd like to hear some of your opinions. I'll open it up to question and answer. I know you all know some things or want to ask some things about what's going on today. I'll do my best to answer them. So anybody want to ask some questions about what's going on with the association? I'm fairly abreast with what's going on. I can probably answer them. Yes, sir.
The question more about the early days. It seemed like
Well, there was, and it's well said on your part, because I know that Yastrzemski was tight with Yawkey. Well, you know, when the vote came down to strike in 72, he and some other guys were like, we're not going to strike, because the ownership had gotten to those guys. There were others that were fairly close, Palmer, with ownership in Baltimore, different guys like that. Now, in fairness, I'll say that these guys came over to our way of thinking down the road, but when true representation was needed with guys that had a voice like that, we didn't have it in as many cases as we really thought we should have. So, as I said, you know, ownership was always trying to make inroads in that area because, you know, they had the golden goose. They didn't want to let go of that. Well, you know, the collusion word came up, didn't it? You know, I watch MLB a lot, of course, because I like those guys. Some of them were my former associates. And I don't think there really was. I just think that some of the ownership came to their senses as far as giving ridiculous contracts to older guys. And some of these guys, I think they thought that they were going to get the big contracts, and it didn't happen. So they were down there at IMG working out, and Ted and I were talking earlier about, you know, what happened to a lot of these guys. And like Alex Cobb, who's one of my kids, you know, he came through our organization all the way when he left. You know, you just don't get in shape playing catch with your buddies at IMG. There's a reason why you have spring training. And look at Batista, what's happened to him. Now, he may be done anyway. I don't know. But I'll guarantee you, he's a shadow of his former self.
About pitching from him, and could you expand on what an outfielder would be having that kind of influence on your thinking?
Well, what Teddy Williams taught me was from the neck up how you pitch to a hitter. You know, here's a guy that's probably one of the greatest hitters that ever lived, and his powers of observation were marvelous, and that's why he had marvelous ability, of course, but knowing what was coming was something that he knew almost all the time, because that's why he said pitchers are stupid, because we can be creatures of habit, and you're going to throw a certain pitch in a certain count, and, you know, that's what he did. So that first spring, when he became our manager in 69, he said to me one day, Bozzy, you got a chance to be pretty good. Now, mind you, I'm coming off a 2-9 year where I really didn't pitch very well most of the year. We were a bad club, but I wasn't very good either. And I said, well, when do we start? And he said, well, you just need to learn to use what you have and how to use it. And I said, well, when do we start? And he said, we're already started. And I just became a disciple at his feet. You know, when he talked about pitching and he talked to me, well, I listened. And it made a huge difference in my career just about right away. Yes, sir.
I'd like to see if you can do a little crystal ball gazing. Bryce Harper is becoming a free agent at the end of the year. And I hear him and Steve Burrows talking about a $350 million contract. And with what's been going on, you know, with some of the players who get the long-term contracts with these huge salaries, is there going to be a trend away from that to have much lower base salaries and for much lower lengths?
Well, you know, I can't tell you what they're thinking over there, but I do know that you're not going to see as big a money as has been talked about. You know, I don't know about base salaries and all that, because, I mean, all that stuff is still open to be negotiated. You know, and, you know, when you're when you're carrying the amount of chips that this guy's carrying, you're going to command quite a contract. Now, I don't think they're going to, I don't think you'll see collusion ever again. I mean, it's too widely known that stuff like that did happen, and I don't think it's going to. I hope it doesn't happen again. It wouldn't be good at all. But I think clearer heads will prevail in that. I don't think you're going to see $400 million. But I don't know what this kid's going to get. He's a heck of a player, isn't he?
Oh, he's. Well, you're talking to a Montreal Expos fan, so I'll leave my comments about Bryce Harper to myself. But no, he is. No, I'm kidding. He is a great ball player. But at the same time, you know, you look at what the Marlins did, and you know, it was a disaster in terms of the overall development of the organization, and they had, you know, they had to trade him to a team like the Yankees that had a much bigger, you know, a lot more money to play with. But that won't that also limit how much that a player like Harper would command, though?
Well, it can. You know, there's probably not only if there's only a few clubs walking around that are going to be able to afford it. I agree with that. But, you know, I mean, it just depends on your revenue stream. This coming from a guy who works for the Tampa Bay Rays, who's got the lowest payroll in the big leagues for obvious reasons.
Right.
You know, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes going forward here. I mean, he's got to have a hell of a year, right? I mean, he's got to play good the rest of the year.
Oh, he does.
You know, so I don't know. I like watching him play, though.
You look great in a Montreal uniform, by the way.
Nick, what year is the current contract or agreement up, and what do you see as the major issues that they'll be facing in the new next negotiation?
I didn't hear the first part of that.
When is this current agreement up?
Oh, well,
and
okay.
What do you see as the major issues?
Well, they got two more years on this thing, as far as I know. And already I hear rumblings of, we screwed up. You know, we allowed this $197 million salary cap thing. And in my mind, I'm like, well, yeah, you did. But I'll guarantee you, you're going to play hell trying to get that back from these owners now. How it's going to play out, I got no idea. But I'll say this. I was talking to Denard Spann in the weight room one day, and I said to Denard Spann, who I'd never met, but we did, and I said, you know, you're probably one of the only guys in that clubhouse that know who Marvin Miller is. And he said, yeah, I probably am. And I said, I think I heard from somebody this spring that if they can't get this thing resolved, they're going to talk about a strike. And I said, let me tell you something, pal. Be careful. There's much money is flying around baseball now, and that word comes up, it'd be a public relations disaster. So we'll see what shakes going forward here. You know, there are a lot of people that say, you know, when Marvin was our executive director, we had a lawyer as our director. You know, he was with the Steelworkers Union before that. Now we've got Tony Clark, who is a former player, and I'm sure Tony does a fine job. But the ins and outs of what's going on, I'm not real sure either. We'll see.
Back in those early days when you were a player rep, you know, there was 24 of you all. In any group of 24, I imagine there's some that are going to be stronger, the leaders. When you were a rep, who were those stronger leaders, and what kind of things did they do that, how did that leadership manifest itself?
Well, Tom Seaver comes to mind immediately. You know, Tom Seaver, Stanford guy. I was fortunate enough privileged to have him as one of my pitchers in Chicago in my very first big league assignment. Joe Torre, Mike Marshall, who was a bit of an eccentric, and an eccentric pitch too with the screwball. These are smart men. These guys understood the issues. These guys could talk to the players in our meetings, and I guarantee I fed off them big time. When we sat in those meetings, I would really listen, especially early on. I didn't say anything. I just listened and wrote down stuff because I was learning on the fly. Because, you know, our bunch in Washington were a bunch of kids that were coming and going. Older guys retired, got released, young kids coming in. And, you know, I had to learn really quick what the issues were. I spent a lot of time with Marvin and Dick Moss, who was his counsel, And those two guys, it'll never be the same. Never will be. But those guys were bright, bright men that Jim Perry comes to mind. You know, another guy that was totally, totally involved with the issues. And those winter meetings that we would have, you know, I mean, they were marvelous. I just couldn't wait to get there to find out and learn more about what was going on.
What do you think about, from two different standpoints, the bullpenning, which the Tampa Bay has been doing a lot, where you have a relief pitcher start a game and is only going to, and you have a bunch of relievers instead. And I know, so what do you think of that from a baseball standpoint? And I know from a union standpoint, I've read that some of the players aren't happy about it because they say it's going to decrease their earning power if they're not being starting pitchers and pitching as many innings and getting more chances for wins.
They may have to create a couple new categories. But, I mean, you know, the reason we're doing it, and, again, I'm in charge of player development in the minor leagues. I don't have anything to do with I develop them, and they can figure out how they want to use them up there. That's the only way I want to do it these days. But, you know, the reason they're doing it, I mean, we've got eight kids right now down with Tommy John surgery, eight. And I would say at least half of them probably would have seen the light of day in the big leagues this summer. The Brent Honeywells, Anthony Bonda, kids like that, that, you know, they were on the cusp or they had gotten there and now they're back. Bonda had a little bit of time up there. Honeywell has not yet. But all of a sudden, we're short a bunch of starters. Hence, our guys on the fourth floor, I call them propeller hats. There's a bunch of guys running up there. They know a lot more about that stuff. They don't know if it's blown up or stuffed, by the way, but they know how fast it's spinning. And their idea is simple. They don't want the starting pitcher to see the front end of the lineup more than twice. Mm-hmm. So you run a reliever out there and let them go through the first five or six guys, and then here comes your length guy, and then, you know, all hands on deck from there. You know, last night we beat the Yankees 2-1. Now, that's the only way we're going to win those games. We're not going to score a lot, Sabathia and that bunch. So you got to pitch like crazy. And, you know, do I like it that way? I don't know. I'm happy where I'm at. As I said, I have no ambition to go back there for a lot of reasons. It would affect my golf game, for one thing. But I don't know. I'm proud of our kids we send. You know, it's still part of me. It's been my 18th year. I still like what I do. What they do with them up there, I know it's controversial. But I don't know what else you'd do. I mean, we just don't have the starters, and they certainly didn't want to drag anybody else in here from somewhere else. So you kind of go with that and see once where you get with it and see if you can piecemeal a few games together.
Given your years as a pitching coach and now the 18 in terms of player development, do you still think of yourself as on the player's side, or have you had to think of that, no, the player's on that side of the fence, I'm now on this side of the fence?
You heard that a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't help it. You know, I mean, I obviously I'm employed by the owner in our front office. And, you know, I guess you might call me an equal rights kind of guy. You know, the industry took in over $9 billion last year. And with revenue sharing and everything else that goes on in our industry, there's plenty of money to go around. You know, and, you know, even as Marvin told us early on, there's money there, fellas. It's going to be up to you to go get it. I'll advise you, but you guys are going to have to be the ones that are going to band together and be unified. And I might say that. I was a little remiss in not. But I'll tell you one thing. When we went out on strike, we were 100% out on strike. There was never any conversation about going back, breaking picket lines, or waiting picket. But there was never any of that. You know, and I don't know the ins and outs of the football strike in the 80s, but I do know that some of the key guys went back to camp as a cooling off period. For me, it was more of a I can't get that olive out of my throat period. So we stuck together, and like I say, it was a point of honor. It was a point of this is the right thing to do here. And, you know, where it goes from here, I don't know. I don't know how many more years I'm going to do this. I still like what I do. And, you know, I'll be the last one to badmouth our ownership. Stu Sternberg's been great to me. But quite honestly, I'm like a player now. I got a one-year deal every year. It's okay. It's all right.
You're kind of used to that one-year, every-year sort of attitude. The question I have is your comments about where you think the areas where, from a labor perspective, there could be some compromise from ownership in the next round of negotiations. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, maybe free agency isn't going to be the place to get the most concessions. Maybe expanding rosters in exchange for a rule change, like getting rid of a DH, which is something designed to keep old players in the game. Maybe if you're looking to get more value in concessions from ownership, maybe there are other places you could go, like raising the minimum salary from 600, whatever it is now, to 1 million or 1.2 million or something like that, and working at some of these other things that concern players, like PED regulations and the minutia of that.
I think that, and again, I'm not totally abreast of what goes on. I don't even sit on the rep meetings anymore. I'd like to, but I don't. I don't think you can tinker with free agency. I don't think you can tinker with arbitration. That's a windfall for the player. You know, you throw a number in and the ownership throws a number in and you're going to get one or the other, and your number is going to be greater than what you made last year. So, I mean, you know, that kind of stuff there, I don't think you're going to tinker with. You can mess around with rosters, and I think that's somewhere that needs to be addressed. How about our club? Our roster changes almost every day. You know, we should own a plane that flies back and forth to Durham, because there's usually somebody or two guys on it every day. So I think a roster thing might be something to talk about. I don't know about minimum salary. I mean, yeah, that's probably something. You know, your health benefits, we all know, everybody in this room knows that our hospitalization insurance and all that's going up every day. So, you know, that's something that probably needs to be talked about. I mean, it's good. You know, all these years we've retained ours, and now it's still the Cadillac of all insurance plans. But there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed coming up. And I just don't think that you can tinker around with free agency and stuff like that. That was way, way too hard fought to get in the first place.
I'm glad you mentioned, regarding collusion, but the agreement was a salary cap, that baseball has one, because I had an argument with a professor that said only one sport has one, and I said last year, no, baseball has one, and she said, no, baseball has a luxury tax, and I said, a luxury tax that acts like a salary cap, and this year we found out, as you said, that was true. The other name, I think, with Marvin Miller that should be in the Hall of Fame is Curt Flood, and he'll never be either. I don't think it's collusion so much, since you asked for opinion, as much as a bad agreement that tied owners' hands as well. Because I know the Giants would have liked to have spent money, but couldn't. I mean, they spend it foolishly anyway, but they would have liked to. But they were up against the ceiling of the cap, and a lot of organizations were like that. Just a bad agreement on both sides, because they tied the level to an absolute dollar amount rather than the revenues. I think at the beginning of the agreement, players were getting over 50% of the revenues. Now they're getting somewhere around 44. So if they tied it like the NBA does to percentage of revenues as revenue grows, you know, players, the amount that teams can spend goes up to a level that they can mm-hmm. accommodate. So part of that is having, like you mentioned, Miller. Miller was the first union guy who, at first look at the reserve clause, said this will never survive scrutiny. A player would have never understood that. Oh. And the players were the biggest enemies at the time. Nobody supported Curt Flood. Not current players, and only two ex-players, Hank Greenberg and Robinson, Jackie Robinson, who are out of the game. No current players. So they were their own worst enemy, because they didn't have a union head like Miller saying, whoa, look at this. And Tony Clark may be a nice guy, but he's a bad negotiator. He was negotiating for little chips, when he should have been negotiating for percentage of the gross. That's just my opinion.
You've been doing your homework.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This might be a tiny bit off topic, but it concerns money. It is apparent right now that the Miami Jeters will easily relieve your stranglehold on the worst attendance at the end of the season. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think Derek's got a plan. I think he inherited a lot of problems. And, you know, it's going to take, as he says, it might take 3-4 years in order to right the ship a little bit. I mean, he's surrounded by some pretty bright guys and some guys with some deep pockets that are local guys. And I think that between he and those guys, I think eventually they'll find their way out of the woods. Now, you know, I don't have a crystal ball to tell you how many years it's going to take to do it, but, you know, there's a few clubs around that are probably as bad or worse than he is, right? Sorry, Lee.
Well, not getting 10,000 people a game and during weekdays about 8,000, that's really bad.
Yeah, we do it all the time.
But for the last several years, you at least wound up with 15,000 at the end of the season.
We actually had 27,000 last night, but the Yankees are in town.
He's looking at half that, so it's...
Yeah. No, it's going to be, but I you know, Derek Jeter's no rock pile. You know, Derek Jeter didn't walk into this thing with his eyes closed. He had to know what was up in front of him. And I guarantee you, he's got a long-distance plan to make this thing work. I hope he does.
We shall see.
Yeah.
Dick, the Tommy John epidemic, what's your take on it? Is it the lack, too much throwing as a kid, not enough work ethic, knowing how to pitch, not playing other sports so your arm doesn't get overdeveloped? Do you have anything beyond it's an individual case for everyone?
You hit on a lot of it already, Lee. You know, Dr. James Andrews is our main guy. You know, Coco Eaton is our local guy who worked under Dr. Andrews. But when a big league guy, a guy in a 40-man gets injured, he has the option of going and getting a second opinion. Of course, they go right up to Birmingham to see Dr. Andrews. I have heard Dr. Andrews speak. He also fixed his shoulder, but it was long after I was done pitching. But anyway, he did. And I've been around him. And, of course, he's always been a big proponent, and he is the one that achieved the pitch count numbers for kids in Little League already. And that's where he says it starts. And, you know, you're abused and not pitched. You don't pitch. You pitch too much, rah-rah, high school, rah-rah, college, and the college coach. Yeah, you can pitch today. You only threw 150 pitches yesterday. And a lot of times that's where a lot of the damage occurs. Now, and we talked about this earlier, too. You're looking at the biggest, strongest, fastest, best-conditioned, best-fed athlete that's ever come down the road. They should be. You know, hopefully we know as much as we know about strength training, nutrition, all the other things that we do now. We got more guys from Yale and Harvard on the fourth floor than we do baseball people. And that's another story for another day. But... This ligament that holds your forearm to your elbow to your upper arm, all right, it's about that long. You can strengthen this, and you can strengthen this and this and every other part of your body, but that cannot be strengthened. Now, and I should look up the numbers on that because I should have them when I talk to you all people. The speed that an arm achieves from the time it's from here through the pitch is one of the fastest human motions ever done. And the amount of force and torque that's put on that ligament in there is far and away more than that ligament was ever designed to withstand. So what do you got here? You got a time bomb going on. You know, we get kids all the time that walk in here and they're throwing 95, 98. You know, there's a kid in the big leagues now that's throwing, what's his name, Hicks? Throws 105. Well, you're holding your breath, aren't you? I mean, you know, everybody's competitive. I mean, you can't, don't throw hard. Don't throw too hard. Well, that doesn't work. You're trying to get the guy out. So this ligament, you know, I mean, it's going to go sooner or later. I was talking to Joel Smith, is our minor league rehab coordinator. This guy is busier than a one-armed paper hanger. This guy all day long does nothing but figure out how to rehab guys, sending reports to ownership and all that stuff. And I was walking through the weight room the other day when I was in Port Charlotte. I said, Joel, You got a theory on this? Because he told me, he said, we got eight guys. We got eight kids that are with Tommy John right now in various stages of recuperation, of course. And he's like, I don't know, Bozzy. He says, the hard throwers blow out. He says, the kids that don't throw 90 hardly ever do. He says, that's just the way it is. So I my heart aches for these kids because, you know, like Honeywell, he was on the edge. He'd have been pitching in the big leagues already. His first batting practice of the spring, five pitches into it, there she goes.
Real quickly, we've got about a minute and a half left for these last questions.
Okay, last question.
Okay, speaking of minor leaguers, if there's one thing that the players' union and ownership seems to agree on, it's screw the minor leaguers financially. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a slippery slope, I think. I mean, yeah, I did it. I went through the whole minor leagues. That's why that carrot's in the big leagues right here. You got to get to the big leagues to get to the rainbow. You get the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Should salaries be higher? Yeah. I can tell you this, because that's what I do. I go through the minor leagues. I go from Durham to Montgomery to Bowling Green to Port Charlotte. I used to go to Hudson Valley and Princeton, but not this year. Conditions are an awful lot better than they ever were before. You should have seen some of the fields I got to play on coming up, and I'm not complaining. We didn't know any better. We were glad we had a uniform on. Kind of raggedy, too, but so what? But should there be some more bucks for these kids? Yeah, I think so. But I don't know. I'm not a big advocate of a lot more money for these guys. I'm really not.
Aren't most of the kids on the minor league rosters fodder to fill in the place for the three or four guys that are real prospects?
Sure.
So why throw money at them?
Well, there's that too, but of course you gotta make a living. Three, four guys are in an apartment all the time. I mean, that's just commonly what you do, which I'm all for. I mean, some of my roommates I had in the minor leagues, I still hear from. We made some wonderful friendships in the minor leagues. You know, we struggled together. We laughed, drank, cried together, the whole deal, you know. I say that, I cherish that, I do. But I mean, the minor leagues are the minor leagues. It's the way it is going up. It ain't easy.
So I know we didn't even have time to get into a lot of topics, such as the Baseball Players Alumni Association. The book is Dick Bosman on Pitching, Lessons from the Life of a Major League Ball Player and Pitching Coach, Ted Levengood and Dick Bosman, available in the vendor's hall at the 50% discount or after the convention at the 30% discount. Dick, as a token of appreciation, a small token of appreciation, here's a copy of the Business of Baseball Winter Meetings, Volume 2, with a lot of great stuff on Marvin Miller. So that'll keep. Thank you very, very much. We appreciate it.
Very, very happy to be here. You guys are the easiest there ever is to speak to because you know so much. I can't tell you any fibs because you catch me on it. But it's easy. You're interested. It's really, really a lot of fun to be here. And, you know, I'd love to do another one sometime when I get time. Ted and I are going to be in there for a little while signing some stuff. So thank you again very much.